To the east, no exit. And again, I'll frame it with some quotations which should tell the story of the lecture by themselves. First, Rudyard Kipling. East is east and west is west, and ne'er the twain shall meet. The second, R.D. Lang, a century later. Today, orientation means to know where the Orient is. Third, Aldous Huxley. Elementary ecology always leads straight to elementary Buddhism. Fourthly, a Zen master, Yun Men. If you want to get the plain truth, be not concerned with right and wrong. Conflict between right and wrong is only the sickness of the mind. And fourthly, a famous quotation from one of the early Buddhists, Buddha Gosa, speaking about the state which you finally arrive at. He says, "There I am nowhere a somewhatness for anyone." Think that one through. And lastly, a famous quotation from Charlie Manson. "If God is one, what is bad? God is one, what is bad?" A second defining feature of the counterculture, and certainly a strong movement within it, is the swing towards the Eastern religions. This goes parallel to the political and social and moral revolutions that our generation has seen. And it's a revolution of consciousness that's equally critical of the present system of society, but one that's dramatically different in its solutions. This swing to the East has changed the whole tidal flow of the last 300 years of radicalism. Up till then, radicalism, revolution, and atheism had always gone hand in hand. So for the first time, a generation has become religious and radical. And strangely, this happened almost overnight and with extraordinary little debate. If we'd been listening a century ago and listened to Kipling's famous line, "The East is East and West is West and ne'er the twain shall meet," probably we would have considered this was extremely well justified. 100 years ago, the British Raj was at the height of its power, and as late as 1830, the Indians were still practicing sati, slavery, and child sacrifice, and so on. In fact, the peoples of India had been servile for centuries, not only underneath the European colonial rule, but also under the Mughals and the Turks before the Europeans. But suddenly, within a generation, the whole balance is changed, and the status quo is upset. And this swing to the East to find philosophical and religious answers is an extremely important trend to understand today. If Western culture is failing to find the answers to its problems in either Christianity as it's rejected it or in the post-Christian humanism, then maybe it is possible that they'll find answers in the East. And this is the important question. The East made its first entry to the counterculture specifically in San Francisco through the early Beats. In some of Ginsberg's earlier poetry, you can see a real quest for God. But Eastern meditation specifically was introduced to the Beats by Gary Snyder, who in 1949 had just returned from Japan and 2 years studying under a Zen master. So it came in through Gary Snyder. But as it spread in the early 50s, the leading figure in the popularization was Alan Watts. Alan Watts, the one-time Christian and Anglican counselor who got heavily into Eastern religions and who, before he was 35, had written 7 books on Hinduism and Zen. For many years, he taught at San Francisco School of Asian Studies. And since then, he's become the foremost spokesman for the East in the States. You can imagine that back in the late 40s and the early 50s, Zen was particularly appealing in the climate of Beat existentialism and general antinomianism. The saying of the ancient Zen master, Lin Chi, ideally suited the philosophy of the early Beats. This is the saying. "In Buddhism, there's no place for using effort. Just be ordinary and nothing special. Eat your food, move your bowels, pass water, and when you're tired, go and lie down." This is the text of Zen, and it soon became the pretext for a Beat Zen, and the atmosphere of those days is very congenial. The rapid acceleration of interest in the East since then hardly needs any documentation. For today you can see the influence of the East everywhere in a rich profusion, if not total confusion. For some of our generation, it's a matter of the utmost seriousness. For others, with minimal understanding and an amazing susceptibility to trends and commercialism, it's only a passing fad or a very shallow commitment. You remember the meditation centers, practice of vegetarianism, Eastern communes, the belief in reincarnation, the wearing of Indian clothes, the enjoyment of sitar music, All of these are familiar now, just as familiar as the blue jeans and beards and rock music of our generation. But on a more serious level, accompanying these, you see the vogue today for the Eastern scriptures. For many people, the Bhagavad Gita, or the Rig Veda, or the Ramayana, or the Pali Canon, or the Tibetan Book of the Dead, are known and read almost as widely as the Bible in certain circles. In New York, I've met blacks who are learning to read Mandarin Chinese in order to study I Ching, or the Book of Changes, in the original. Another important parallel is that the popularity of the novels touching on the Eastern religions. Siddhartha, or the Glassbeak Game by Hermann Hesse, being very popular, and Island by Aldous Huxley are all good examples. And the last few years has seen a complete proliferation of the sects. Baha'i and Soka Gakkai, the true sect of Nichiren, growing rapidly in many parts of the United States as well as in Europe. But above all, there are the many thousands of young people on the road to the East, some spiritually, some physically, some with a really intense dedication are working in the villages and the communities in India. Others are searching seriously, initiated under gurus and studying in the ashrams, while most of them are just delighted to find that Kabul or Kathmandu is a heaven for dropouts, with food and drug and drugs and leisure in celestial proportions for those who've made it. In other words, just in the last 25 years, we've seen Kipling completely turned on his head. But if Kipling was wrong, this trend had been foreseen by others. Just after the turn of the century, James Joyce prophesied, "The West shall shake the East awake." Marshall McLuhan from Canada wrote recently, "Soon, in order to westernize our kids properly, we'll be sending them all to the East." And it was in that context that Ali Lang made this rather clever pun. Today, orientation means to know where the Orient is. The point is this: the East is still very much the East, but the West is no longer the West. Western answers no longer seem to fit the questions. And in a post-Christian culture with the disintegrating elements of humanism, many are finding no alternative but to search towards the ancient East. So let's try and understand this. I think we can only appreciate this by looking at some of the factors behind the movement, and this is where we'll begin. Now, I stress that this section is not put in because of the importance of the argument, but just to give you a broad sketch and outline of why the swing towards the East, so that we can really appreciate it. Because if you want to speak to people who are on the road to the East and really speak to them with integrity, one really need to know why they are where they are, or they generally tend not to listen to you, and two, you need to give a really valid answer to what they're saying. So first of all, the factors behind, the why they are where they are. And we need to appreciate that in a certain sense, this is extremely understandable. Now, I've just located three main factors, the first rather trivial, and the second two rather more important. The first factor I describe as stirrings in the West. Stirrings in the West. In many areas today, it'd be easy to show you that Western thought is somewhat played out, somewhat anemic and lifeless. With the failure of Western Christianity and secular humanism, modern thinking has reached a terminus. Hendrik Kramer, a professor at Yale, writes like this, Princeton rather, "There is evident in the fields of pictorial arts, novels, thinking and depth psychology, a kind of premonition. They manifest a spontaneous openness, a readiness to be invaded, to be spiritually colonized by the Orients. These are the open gates for an Eastern invasion." In other words, what Dr. Schaefer calls the Western escape from reason has produced a twin reaction. On the one hand, to more sensitivity and imagination generally, and on the other hand, to more sensitivity and imagination and mysticism from the East particularly. And you can see in the last century and a half, many thinkers and poets and artists and musicians in the West who began to search towards the East for the impulses of their answers. The philosopher Schopenhauer warmly appreciated Buddhism and was influenced by his reading of the Upanishads. Goethe showed great interest in the East. If you read the papers of Wagner, Richard Wagner, you have evidence there that he studied Buddhism, and you can see in an opera like Tristan and Isolde that you have there an expression of heavy Eastern pessimism. Or in England, you have the poem of Sir Edwin Arnold, The Light of Asia. And in many of these instances, what you see is Western intellectuals looking towards the East for answers and approaches because of the bankruptcy of Western thought. Now, you could say a lot more about this, but this is an area we cover very fully here in Farrell House, so I'll just skip this one. A second factor and feature of much greater importance is the stirrings in the East itself. What we've seen in the last 100 years is nothing short of a total rediscovery of the Eastern culture, especially in the richness of the heritage of India. In other words, the India of the British Raj was no more the real India than the Britain of the 1970s was the Britain of the British Empire. As we go back and see more of India's history, two features are coming to light, and both of them are of paramount importance. The first is that India's culture has a historic continuity from her prehistoric origins right down to the present. And this continuity has been one which no foreign conquest or invasion has ever managed to break. It's changed and altered, but has never broken. So you've got a unique culture. There again, there are many aspects in this culture that demand our highest respect. The philosophy of Shankara in the 9th century AD is as sophisticated and as diverse as any philosopher in the West has produced. And some have even put him on a par with Plato and Thomas Aquinas combined. You have a psychology in the East which was certainly primitive, but developed thousands of years before the West even thought of the term. And the same could be said in the areas of astronomy and commerce. If any of you have been to India and have seen the caves of Elarona Junta, you can see there sculpture and frescoes, some of which even rival those in Florence of the Renaissance, and so on. The second point, though, is much more important than this. The second point is that through the origins of Aryanism, i.e. the people who settled India, Hinduism has a direct relationship with our European culture. Now, this is important because just at the moment that Europe and America are being dechristened, in other words, they're losing their Christian foundations, they're both feeling themselves in danger of losing their soul, their raison d'etre. So as our culture searches for a new basis, searches for its pre-Christian roots, it's finding itself in certain areas much closer to the origins of India than to the roots of pre-Christian and pre-Judeo-Christian Europe. Now, very probably the reason for this is that the origins of the Greeks lived very close in geography to where the origins of the Aryans came from. So they both spread out like this, one down to Greece and the other through into northern India, mixing with the culture that was already there. You can see in various places that the Greeks are much closer to the Indians than either are to our Judeo-Christian culture. You just mentioned two areas. One would be the question of time. How do we view the flow of time? Both the Greeks and the Hindus viewed time as cyclical, going round totally in cycles, and limitless. Those are the two important words, cyclical and limitless. Whereas men in the Judeo-Christian tradition have always viewed time as linear, teleological, and limited. Very important implications flow out of that. Another point of contrast is the question of reality. What is this reality which we see? The Greeks viewed the ancient world, the external universe, as the shadow, as a world of shadow, which was less true or less real than the ideal, which is beyond their knowledge. Similarly, the Hindus paralleled this by saying that the external universe around us which we see was only a world of illusion, or what they called Maya, while the true reality is Brahman or beyond. Now this is in total contrast to the Christian and Jewish view of God's creating a world of reality, which was not merely the extension of his essence, but was a world which he created real and distinct from himself. You probably know that Pythagoras is a teacher of reincarnation, and even Plato taught an Eastern type of asceticism and recognized the need for illumination as well as for philosophy. And this is all very similar to what was later developed in India in meditation. In other words, you see these tremendous parallels between pre-Christian Europe and the origins of India through Aryanism. And this is giving many modern scholars clues to a possible basis of our culture today. Now, in this renaissance of Indian studies, there have been three main channels or avenues of discovery. The first, but by far the least important, was the work of patient scholarly research and government-sponsored investigation. When the British arrived in India, many of the caves were completely lost, some of the temples are in ruins, and certain of the rituals were no longer practiced, and even the Taj Mahal was being used as stables for horses. Even much of the greatness of India's past in history and so on had been totally forgotten. And it was only towards the end of the 18th century, with the work of many great lovers of the East who'd come from Britain and founded things like the Royal Asiatic Society, that for the first time the Indians began to realize the richness of their tradition. They translated the texts, they renovated the temples, they maintained the rituals, all of this on the British government's expense. They rediscovered the caves, and they brought to light all the richness of Indian history. So for the first time, the Indians began to realize the amazing richness of their heritage behind them. Here was the first avenue. The second and more important avenue of rediscovery was the translation of the various sacred texts of the East. Max Müller in Germany founded and edited the famous Sacred Books of the East. In England, a professor and Mrs. Davids worked in the Pali Canon of the Buddhists. And it was through these and other great Orientalists that for the first time Western scholars had the Eastern writings in their own native languages. In other words, up till then they dimly heard of these things, but for the first time these things were in English and German and French available for Western scholars to study. So they came to be aware of the Rig Veda. The Rig Veda is the early Hindu poems of creation. Or the Vedanta, the great body of Hindu literature. Or the Bhagavad Gita, which some people describe as the crowning portion of the Vedanta, and some even refer to as the Bible of the Hindus. Or the Ramayana, which is the book of the myths that they have. Or the Pali Canon, which is the Buddhist scriptures. So for the first time, these are translated into Western languages, and scholars realized here was not something just primitive, which stories of the practices and lives of India brought back, but something immensely rich and profound. Now the third avenue of rediscovery, and by far the most important, was the patient work of the various apologists from the East. The first of these is a man called Raja Ram Mohan Roy, who's popularly called the Father of India. And he lived in the 18th century, from 1772 to 1833. Interestingly, his work, like many of the others, was in direct reaction to the work of missionaries like William Carey. Carey went into India and was one of the pioneers in bringing in the printing press, a new status for women, and in introducing medicine to his part of India. And Roham Ram Roy was at first attracted by Christianity and Western education, and in fact studied the Bible under the Serampore missionaries like Carey. He even felt that Christian truths, as he wrote, are more conducive to moral principles and better adapted for the use of rational beings than any others. But what this man saw was that if Hinduism did not reform itself, soon it would be leapfrogged and outflanked by Christianity. So what he did was to found the Brahmo Samaj, or the Hindu reform movement. The essence of Hinduism is relativism, so it can reform and adapt to anything new at all. So he tried to update Buddhism, or Hinduism rather, by a reform movement, and so everything the Christian missionaries raised the question of, such as the printing press, the position of women, etc., he would do the same thing in the name of an updated Hinduism. So he led the attack on sati, the burning of widows, which was declared illegal in 1929. He attacked child marriages and so on. All of these which had been earlier attacked by the Christian missionaries from Britain. Next in importance came Ramakrishna, who lived 1836 to 1886. A man who was devoted supremely to Kali, the great mother goddess and patron of Calcutta. But he also claimed visions of Muhammad and Christ and many of the other religious figures of the world. His importance was this. Up till his time, Hinduism was virtually synonymous with Indian. And Hinduism saw itself as having no sphere of influence wider than the boundaries of India. But his uniqueness was to see that Hinduism was capable of being a world religion because it had a relativistic truth which could swallow up all others. And he claimed Hinduism as the crown of the world's religion. His work was grounded and spread by the third man, his disciple, the Swami Vivekananda, who lived 1863 to 1902. Vivekananda, too, was educated at a mission college in Calcutta. And he was the heir, the spiritual heir to Ramakrishna, and founded the Ramakrishna Mission. So that today you can go to many parts of the East, and you'll land at the airport, and you'll see there not the Hertz and the Avis representatives, or rather you'll see them too. You'll see the Ramakrishna Mission desk next to them, and so on. What it does is to combine preaching with social action. He became really world famous in 1893, when unknown and totally unnoticed and poor, he crossed to the States and came to the first Parliament on World Religions in Chicago. He was unscheduled to speak, but he spoke anyway, and totally captivated the audience with his soft and persuasive way of speaking. And through this, he rapidly and dramatically gained the wider ear of the States and became a drawing room, living room celebrity around the States at the end of the last century. Developing the commitment of Ramakrishna, what Vivekananda did was to take the philosophy of the 9th century Shankara and breathe fire into it and make it relevant to his own times. He stood up and claimed that Hinduism was the mother of all religions. He said, "We accept all religions as true, but Hinduism is the mother and crown of them all." And this is the updated Vedantism, or the Neo-Vedantism, which later in our own century was so strongly to impress such people as Aldous Huxley, and today is very heavily influencing our generation. A reporter for the New York Herald who listened to him at one of his lectures said, "After hearing this man, we feel how foolish it is to send missionaries to this learned nation." And this shows you the complete switch in thinking that there had been in 100 years. He traveled very widely in the States and Europe and achieved great popularity. And he died at the age of 39, and his death was mourned as a national calamity in India. Also in the last century, another great influence was the founding of the Theosophical Society. If Vivekananda gave Hinduism self-consciousness, then it was the Theosophical Society which gave it self-pride. It was founded by Westerners, actually, English and Americans, who'd gone to India. And that their zeal often outran their discretion. And today, very few Indians would agree with what their theology is, a strange amalgam of Hinduism, Buddhism, and the cult. But they were quite widespread in their influence. Another important man coming this time into our own century was Sri Aurobindo. Like many of the more recent ones, he had the benefits of an English education, including the classics at Cambridge. And at first was an important leader of the nationalist politics in India. But after a vision in 1910, Aurobindo retired to found an ashram down in Pondicherry and to write his book, The Life Divine, hoping that with his ideas of cosmic consciousness, he could call the whole world to peace and unity and have a kind of religious communism. He remained there the rest of his life and suffered an acute disillusionment because very few people came to his views. And in the closing years, he was very frustrated and disillusioned. The ashram is still there, and it's very important. Today it's led by a French woman who is the leader of the community. His ideas, incidentally, are very close to that guy who was here yesterday that many of us were talking to at lunch. In our own century, several leaders stand out. There's Rabindranath Tagore, who was the Leonardo of the Bengal Renaissance. An amazing man who was a poet, dramatist, actor, composer, painter, philosopher, prophet, all rolled in one. And to think of such more recent people as Mahatma Gandhi and Dr. Radhakrishnan, we hardly need mention their names. But perhaps for our generation, the point of most influence has been the work of the various gurus. Krishnamurti, the so-called intellectuals guru, who holds court here in Switzerland every 2 years. Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, Meher Baba, Yogananda, many, many others. And on the Buddhist side, supremely important, D.T. Suzuki of Kyoto, Japan. And all of these have got an amazing number of followers, some with a very shallow commitment, others with a deeply serious understanding. Among those who follow Suzuki closely You could number in the States John Cage, Eric Fromm, and in Europe, Martin Heidegger. He's very close to him in certain ways. So here's the second great important factor, the renaissance and rediscovery of the significance and culture and heritage of the East as it's been channeled to us in these three ways. The third great factor, and this is, I think, the most important of all, is the way the climate of the post-Christian West fits in so perfectly with the climate of the ancient East at many significant points. We've seen a convergent coincidence of the Eastern thought with the post-Christian Western thought. And clearly, as Christianity is the odd man out in so many areas, rejected as being out of date now, these two are joining in many of these areas to form a new climate that's almost inescapable. I'm not saying that the East has directly influenced the West, but rather there's a series of what Alan Watts called parallelisms, more and more plays, a series of dovetailings or coincidings. And you could see this in a whole panorama of areas. For example, if we had time, we could look at the question of man's origins, right down to the question in the future of man's utopian hopes. And in many, many areas between these, from the origins to the future, you can see these same things, the parallelisms, the coincidings, the dovetailings. In some of these, the coincidence is very real. In some of these, it's only apparent and, in fact, very unfortunate. And in others, it's completely mistaken and unfounded. And I can give you examples from each of these areas. I'll just mention two. Two very important ones today. One of which is real. In other words, they really do fit together. And one of which is ostensible and plausible in our climate, which is, in fact, not true. And we need to blow apart the myth. But the one which is real, we'll take the example of philosophy and the discussion of whether or not there's a God. And if there is a God, can he speak, and can he speak meaningfully? Because here you'll see that both the East and the post-Christian West fit in beautifully to say that there are only two alternatives. Either sheer silence or mere symbolism. The sheer silence of atheism and the mere symbolism of mysticism. Let me show you how both these fit together. In some ways, it's surprising that the concept of God lasted so long as it did in Western philosophy. For although many philosophers believed vaguely in a personal God or used the concept in their arguments, very few had an adequate view of knowing why. In other words, very few had a basis in a genuine understanding of revelation, outside of which you cannot hold to God except in a mystical sense. So with the failure of revelation, we've seen various quick steps down to the present position of mere symbolism or sheer silence. The details of the step, we won't bother about this afternoon, I'll just go through very quickly, but just to get the flow in your minds. The first step was with Immanuel Kant, because Kant made a complete dichotomy or divergence between what he called the noumenal, which was things in themselves, and the phenomenal, which was things as they are towards us. So Kant would say, I see this here, I can feel the wood of it and see the shape and the color, etc., the sound if I bang it, etc. In other words, I can see, feel, empirically verify only the phenomenal, this as it is towards me or towards you. But the thing as it is in itself, the noumenal, is beyond. There's a complete divorce between the noumenal and the phenomenal. And the noumenal was in the area which he called the totally other, totally other. Only the phenomenal is knowable. The noumenal is the world of the philosophical beyond. Little step. The second step was when the Austrian philosopher at Cambridge, Wittgenstein, developed this by saying that the sphere of language, in other words, the area which language could handle, was the area only of the phenomenal, that which is open to sense verification. So although we can speak of the noumenal, the totally other, we must really beware of being hexed by the bewitching nature of language. Because really, words and concepts and verbalization cannot penetrate the unknown and unknowable noumenal. So he made a very important conclusion, which is a significant sentence for modern philosophy. Whereof one cannot speak, thereof one must be silent. So the phenomenal and noumenal are separated. Language can only speak of the phenomenal, the world that can be verified through the senses. So whereof one cannot speak, i.e. the noumenal, thereof one must be silent. There are no words you can use. Now what he did, in other words, was to relegate God to the world of the noumenal. And this means that theology, or the discussion of God and how God reveals himself, reduces theology to silence. Now for Wittgenstein, this was a silence of mysticism. In other words, he believed that God was there, and he believed it was important that God was there, but he didn't think you could speak about God, although he was there, because language could not get to God. Almost as if this room was our universe, and the ceiling of the room is the boundary of finiteness. Anything above the ceiling is the world of the noumenal, or the infinite world. So language is limited to this room. And our words are like arrows which are using to puncture the ceiling to get through, but we don't know if they arrive or not, because it's the world of the beyond, the unknowable. It wasn't that God had failed for Wittgenstein, it was that language had failed. That was step two. Now, the next step went on very quickly, though, to the third stage of atheism, which is to say that if you can't talk about him but he's there, how do you know he's even there? Maybe it's nonsense that he is there. This is developed particularly by A.J. Ayer in linguistic analysis. And this arrives down at the sheer silence of atheism. For A.J. Ayer, he says it's impossible for a sentence even to be significant and refer to God. God is in the area beyond sense verifications. In other words, he's in the area beyond sense. He's in the area of nonsense, i.e. nonsense. So where we are today, this leaves the present discussion with only two possibilities. You either have the sheer silence of the atheist, which is very common, or the mere symbolism of the mystic. In other words, that you're using words as symbols to try and puncture the ceiling, but you never know if they really finally make it. Now that really describes the modern atheistic world in the West, as well as the modern liberal theological world in the West, with its symbolism. In much liberal theology, theological language is not what God, who is there, means about himself as he speaks down to man, but rather man as he's here, speaking about a God he trusts there, speaking upward. It's symbolic truth. As a theologian has called it, silence qualified by religious parables. This means that history, such as in the scriptures, is explained as myth, and faith is removed from groundings in fact. And all you're left with is religious connotation words. In other words, you're using the words God and Jesus, etc., and everyone has the right emotional reactions, but who knows if the arrows are puncturing the ceiling? The atheists are far more honest in admitting this lacks integrity. If you can't speak about God meaningfully, how do you know that he's there at all? For the atheist, of course, there's only silence of sheer atheism, however hard or unwelcome. This is the sort of picture you have painted by Bergman. If any of you know the genesis of Bergman's films, the real turning point in Bergman, the watershed, is in his film Winter Light, 1961. And in this film you have the priest who's struggling to find faith, Thomas. You have a doubting priest who's struggling to find faith. And he has a very barren counseling session when he talks to one of his parishioners who's on the verge of suicide. And he counsels not human comfort, but total despair. And the man goes out and commits suicide. And the priest, who's got no faith left, just gazes up at the grotesque wooden crucifix in the deserted Swedish church. And he moans to himself, looking at this crucifix, my God, why have you abandoned me? But as Bergman writes in the script, there is only God's silence, Christ's twisted face, the blood on the brow and the hands, the soundless shriek behind the bared teeth. And eventually the priest looks down and he gasps, no, God does not exist anymore. And that was the turning point in his films. And from then on, for Bergman, as he says, there was only the echo God, the echo of my arrows bounding back to me, the lie God, or the spider God. God no longer speaks, and soon without divine revelation, there's no longer meaning in the world without God either. He went on to take his next film, which he called in 62, Silence. The absurdity and hell of a world in which God is no longer speaking. There's no revelation to give answers to men who can't find them. Interestingly, John Cage has called his autobiography, Silence. and a recent play by Harold Pinter is also called Silence. So you see what it is in the West. Mere symbolism or sheer silence. Two alternatives. But this is what the East has always said. And this fact has not gone unnoticed in the West. Martin Heidegger listened to Suzuki lecturing one day and said that if he understood Suzuki correctly, he was saying exactly the same thing through his own existentialism. Interesting that John Robinson's book, Honest to God, and Paul Tillich's books are widely read in India, and you can see them in the libraries of many of the ashrams. One Swami in India pointed to Honest to God by Bishop Robinson and said to me, "But surely your Western theologians are saying exactly what we've been saying all the time." And it's true, they are. You remember Tillich at the end of his life was asked by a student, "Sir, do you pray?" And Tillich replied, "No, I meditate." Prayer is only meaningful if your words puncture the ceiling and you know what you're talking about and to whom you're talking. If you don't, it's a God who's beyond. All you have is meditation. Of course, liberal theology has no propositional content and no verbal revelation. Theological meaning is only what man means about God, and then only results in meditation. This leads us exactly where the East has already been. And in the East, you can see that Hinduism is closer to modern theology, and Buddhism is closer to modern atheism. In other words, Hinduism parallels the mere symbolism, and Buddhism brilliantly parallels the sheer silence. In Hinduism, you have Shankara, and his monism is typical of the mainstream of thought. And constantly, he said, the only final thing you could say about God was that he was neti neti, N-E-T-I, N-E-T-I, which means he's not this, not that. In other words, when you try and put concepts of God into any words at all, you miss the point so much you can't say this, because he's not this, not that. Anything you say goes too far one way or the other. God is always beyond. He's unknowable in his pure essence. Any description we give him in terms of any words or pictures is only a reduction, a symbol for our understanding. He's not like that, because he cannot be known in any rational, conceptual, or verbal thought of any time, of any kind. He's known only through intuition or meditation. And the essence of both of these is that they're non-rational or super-rational. Shankara used to tell the story of a pupil of his who kept asking a master about the nature of Brahman or God or the absolute self. What was God like? And each time the question came, the master would just turn a deaf ear and ignore him. Until finally he turned impatient in his student and said, "Can't you see I'm teaching you, but you haven't understood? The true self is silence." There's a well-known saying in the Upanishads, "The gods love the obscure and hate the obvious." And you can see this at many, many points in their thinking. A modern Indian philosopher puts it like this. In other words, you can't speak about God, but you do speak about God because you need to. So your idols, whether they're in words or stone, are your pictures of God because you need them. And this Indian philosopher admits this honestly. He says the particular name and form of any deity are only limitations which we in our weakness impose on the all-pervading spirit who is really nameless and formless. The supreme being is a person only in relationship to ourselves. In other words, he's not personal, but we need him to be personal, so we think of him as such. In himself, he's impersonal. He goes on, the highest theism is only a sort of glorified anthropomorphism, but we cannot do without it. Exactly what Freud would say. Men create the God that they need. And so they admit that God isn't exactly like this in Hinduism, but each man needs a God like this. So whether it's a very sophisticated one like the philosopher's conception, or a very crude one like the little man in the villages throwing down his food or his blood before an idol, he's creating a God he needs. It's his representative symbol of God. Buddhism is closest, on the other hand, to the sheer silence of Western atheism. It's said that whenever Buddha was asked who God was, he always answered, his disciples said, in terms of resolute or roaring silence. And once he said, "And why, monks, have I not declared it? Simply because it's not profitable." normally Buddha is considered an atheist. Although certain people today are saying that Buddha is a mystic, rather like Wittgenstein, with a very acute insight into the problem of language, so that you can't speak about God, but maybe he's there, but most people say he's an atheist. It's said that when Buddha was about to enter his final nirvana, he assembled all his followers in the Vulture Peak, and he just sat before them in silence. And finally, after some minutes, he picked a flower and held it out in front of them. And he watched his disciples to see which of them, after all these years, would have some sign that they understood what he was saying. After a few minutes of silence, all of them except one were bemused, and really puzzled expressions were on their faces. Only one, Mahakasyapa, smiled comprehendingly. And Buddha stretched out his hand and congratulated him as the only one who'd understood what he was talking about, or literally why he wasn't talking at all. Because he said, final truth is only in being, and this knowledge is beyond words. You probably have heard this reflected in many of the current sayings now in vogue on our campuses. Lao Tzu's famous line, those who know do not speak, and those who speak do not know. And the whole of Zen is concerned with the subtle paradoxes of language. And you have in Zen the idea of the koan, which is a kind of intellectual karate chop or an intellectual teaser, a little intellectual time bomb, designed to make your mind work so fast and then to jolt it into seeing that you can't work at the answer by reason alone. And then suddenly you'll quickly flip upstairs into a non-rational intuition. And that's alone where the true self lies. So they have these little teasers like, tell me, what's the sound of one hand clapping? Or, what was the look on your face the day before you were born? And so on. When you start to answer these, rationality falls flat in its face, trying too hard. And it's only then, they say, that you see the higher levels of super-rational knowledge. And then you get up to the true knowledge, which is beyond words. So you surely see how Hinduism, with its mere symbolism, is very close to liberal theology in many points. Whereas Buddhism, with its sheer silence, is very close to modern atheism. And all of them together, the four of them, there's a coinciding or a dovetailing or a parallelism which creates a climate in which anyone thinking about God, either way, for or against, it's very easy to think in these terms. I spent almost too long on that first coincidence, but the picture should be plain. Intellectually, both East and post-Christian West have arrived at the same point. And what's the odd man out? Well, clearly the odd man out is anyone who believes in revelation. A God speaking down to man, meaning to man what he means about himself, and God delivering and defining the meaning. But of course, that's the odd man out, of course. So we have the position of mere symbolism or sheer silence. Of course, you could also add, emotionally, the commitment to an intriguing silence contrasts extremely well with the garrulous preachiness of much Christianity. I think this is one reason why the East is a natural harbor for our generation, which ever since the Beats has often seen people who are very inward and inarticulate in their moodiness. Let's look quickly at a second example of this coincidence, rather quicker this time. Another important one, and this is in the area of ecology. Ecology and the question of what is the basis for a proper treatment of nature. Now here what we'll see is a parallelism that's actually mistaken. It's an unfortunate one. Few people would deny that Western industrial society has been conspicuous for its failure to treat nature well. Through our ignorance and our haste and our economic greed in every field, the rape of nature has really become a vivid reality. The question is, why is this? Many of you probably know the article by Lynn White Jr., who's typical of many who are now blaming Christianity for the disaster. And Lynn White says that Christianity is to blame because it made man so much higher than nature, so distinctively different from nature, that he went on and thought that he had the right to dominate nature. In the light of this, other people have gone on since Lynn White to say then that the only answer to the Christian abuse of nature is pantheism. In other words, pantheism will give you a respectful treatment of nature because man is at ground seen as being one with nature. You see this all over the place today. It's a very popular view on campuses. Aldous Huxley believed this strongly. That's where I quoted from his novel The Island, written in 1962. This is his answer to The Brave New World. And in this, his little island community, based on scientific humanism and Buddhism combined, the ideal is worked out, and very basic to it is the ideal of the fact that ecology and Buddhism are basic to his solutions. The little children, the school children on the island, the first lessons they learn are ecology. And that's where that statement I read comes in. Elementary ecology leads straight to elementary Buddhism. In other words, when man understands that he and nature are absolutely one on a primary physical natural level, then he can really treat nature and respect it rightly. You've probably heard this argument all around the campuses today. Christianity is to blame. Pantheism is the answer. So let's take to the Eastern religions to give us a healthy, respectful view of nature. Probably these arguments will increase. But yet here's, another coincidence, but here's one which is absolutely bogus, and we need to expose it. This argument has no more than surface plausibility. Only a little study will show that although Christians have to admit their share of the guilt for their complacency about doing nothing about nature, and their silence when it was done by others, this general complacency is a gross caricature of the true Christian position. And the real position is exactly the reverse. In fact, historic Christianity sees man as distinct from nature, but not divorced. On the level of personality, man is distinct from nature, distinct from the rest of finite creation, finding his fulfillment for his personality only in God. But at the level of the finiteness, in other words, there's a balance to this in Christianity, at the level of his finiteness, man is one with nature because he too is part of the wider finite creation. So he has real differences and yet a true relationship towards nature. And this true relationship is the source of his responsibility and his respect for nature. And that's exactly which pantheism doesn't have, this balance between. As Dr. Schaefer has often shown, far from, this is pantheism now, far from raising the lower, i.e. nature, to the level of the higher man, what pantheism tends to do in practice is to lower the higher, i.e. man, to the level of the lower, i.e. nature. I was in India a couple of years ago and was checking out in various areas if this is really true. You can see, for example, that paradoxically, the cow, although it's sacred in India, is treated worse, short of being killed, than the cows in most other countries of the world. There's a great differentiation in treatment of the cows in India, and some are even pampered as home pets. But generally speaking, there are far too many cows in India. And they not only take the food that's needed for humans, but many of them are themselves close to starvation. It's very striking in India to go through the main streets of the capital, Delhi. You see cows standing up on their hind legs, tearing the paper off the ads on the walls, or the posters on the walls, nosing off with their horns the lids of dustbins, garbage cans, Americans, to try and get in and eat the food that's in there. And you can see the same point even more clearly in the Indian attitude towards vermin. Several times in New Delhi, again the capital, you'd see people putting rats over the walls into their neighbors' gardens, refusing to kill them because of the doctrines of nonviolence. A United Nations expert there told me that every year in India, the vermin eat enough food to feed the entire population of Canada. But nothing's done about this because of the religious taboos. In other words, sufficient food which would solve the problems of any of the big major states that were having starvation problems. But they're unable to tackle the problems because of their views of nature. So you see, far from raising the lower nature to the level of the higher man, in many areas what it tends to do is to lower the higher man to the level of the lower nature. So here's these two views, the question of God and the question of ecology. And as I could say, you could look into many, many other areas, evolution, the space-time scale, parapsychology, cosmic consciousness, etc., etc. And in all of these, we'd see the same story. Sometimes it's genuine, sometimes it's false, and I'll give you an example of each. There's been a coincidence, a parallelism, between the Western thought today and the post, or rather the post-Christian Western thought today and the Eastern thought of yesterday. And so it's not unnatural that you have a climate in which Westerners can look for intellectual impulses from the Eastern thought. Now let me just underline all this. In other words, we've seen these three important factors. Underline all this by stressing just a few more comparative details as to why the swing and how understandable it is. Because I think we must really feel the force of how understandable it is. Another factor, of course, is that the swing to the East has come just at a time when Christianity is so weak that it can hardly stand at those points it would need to stand if it had the strength to. Without this strength at certain points, the Eastern religions will be to Christianity, and this is an important point to notice, a new type of Gnosticism. But unlike the Gnosticism which the early church faced, this time I'm afraid for many people the fight will be lost even before they've seen the danger, because they've lost the important pieces in the chess game before they started it. For example, modern Christianity is crucially weak at several points, such as a strong understanding of revelation. But if you don't have that strong understanding of revelation, you're back to the sheer silence or the mere symbolism. Modern Christianity is drastically weak in terms of an unmediated experience, personal experience and knowledge of God. So in many churches, what passes for religious experience is a kind of communal emotion, which you feel in church services, drummed up by meetings and singing and contrived fellowship, but outside by themselves, these individuals don't know God. Again, the modern church is pathetically feeble in its expression of its principles of community. Instead, it's become the local social club, the preaching shop, or the minister-dominated group. And with weaknesses just such as these three, modern Christianity cannot hope to understand why people have gone to the East, let alone stand against the trend and offer a genuine alternative. And I think this is why many within the church have an understanding of their faith that's extremely blurred at the edges. And that's why they're so vulnerable to this Eastern thinking. I particularly found this down in areas like California, where the Eastern ideas are so prevalent. I remember a while back I was in Northern California, speaking in a church, and a woman came up to me afterwards and wanted to describe to me very excitedly a vision she'd had. And she was trying to show to me how wonderful this was. And she was a member of a very large evangelical church. And in this vision, she'd been on holiday in New Mexico, and she'd seen Christ standing by a river, and Christ had said, "Follow the river as it flows." And in her dream or her vision, she'd done this, and she'd followed the river down. And down she went, and she met St. Anthony and St. Francis, the Roman Catholic saints. A bit further down, she met the Indian monkey god, and a little later down, Shiva and Brahma and Vishnu. And at the end of this long vision and all these various deities from around the world, Christ met her again and said, "See, we're all one after all." And with this vision in mind, she was building this into her Sunday school with intense excitement. I was at an ashram in India a couple of years ago and was in a room next to a Canadian Roman Catholic professor. And he spent long hours at meals, because you were silent at meals in the ashram, long hours between the meals, telling me that his new understanding of Hinduism was really the first shot in the arm he'd found for his decaying Roman Catholic faith. Here was a man going back to teach in a Roman Catholic seminary in the States. So here you have a Christianity that's weak in these areas, very vulnerable to all these ideas, and so many people's faith is blurred that they have no critical control of what's genuine and what's not. However, there is much in the East that's very valid and sensitive, and much that we should acknowledge as true. For example, on a general level, their emphasis on the spiritual is a welcome contrast to gross materialism. And their stress on quiet stillness is a very welcome relief from the hectic rush of Western society. And there are many other things that one could mention, such as the physical exercises, the concentration, the mind control, the ability to determine the blood pressure and the heart rate and so on. Many, many other things from the high level down to the practical level, which are very sensitive and useful in the Eastern religions. From traveling widely in the East myself, from many conversations here with people who have been on the road to the East or coming back, I think that the basic appeal to the East is to understand that all that I've said is the general climate, and so to see that the appeal is by force of contrast with what they've experienced before in the West. And this is really why the East is so strongly appealing. The East stresses experience, not theory, and thus is a welcome relief from the sterile memory of preachers and pulpits 6 feet above contradiction and life. For the East, verification is via participation. The inner soul of the East, the Tat Tvam Asi, the Thou Art That, is not a metaphysical proposition of words. It's a psychological experience. As a guru said to me with a fair measure of accuracy, to many of you Christians, your talk about God is rather like the great bulk of an iceberg, whereas your experience of God is only the tiny tip above water. But for we in the East, the experience of God is the great bulk of the iceberg, whereas our talk about God is only the tiny tip. And that's certainly true for very many. Again, the East stresses integration and not an isolated individualism, which is a mark of the West. And it's this insight into the oneness with nature which often brings a sense of flooding release and relief and peace and joy. And this is all the more real by force of contrast with the individualism and alienation which are so often the experience of the sensitive person in our materialistic industrial society. One has a lot of sympathy for Alan Watts when he speaks generally of modern Christianity's sheer genius for drabness, or what he calls its constipation of the bright emotions, or when he describes an average service, and personally I think this comes a lot too close to our own. He says, participants sit in rows, merely looking at the backs of each other's necks, and sometimes are only in communication with the leader. Many of these points you can see, you can really understand that by force of contrast with what they've experienced in the West, the appeal and all the richness of what I just described to these three factors has a great appeal for our generation. And we've seen this great swing towards the East. We'll have a couple of minutes break now, and then I'll go on into a critique of it. Now let's move on to critique of the East. And here we'll look not so much at some of their practices, such as the caste system, nor at just some of their particular beliefs, such as reincarnation, etc., but rather we'll look at their basic premises. In other words, the presuppositions, the prior theoretical commitments of their thought, and the overall results of these premises in their culture. To put it another way, we'll see how their view of the nature of ultimate reality works out practically as it washes down in the rain of normal living. And here my critique will focus mainly on one stream of Hinduism, and we'll just make occasional references to Buddhism and some of the other streams. The basic premises of Hinduism are those of monism. Now, this half lecture, really think through the argument with me. There's a great range of thought in Hindu theology. In fact, you could see it one way, that there are as many gods as there are Indians. The early stages were strongly polytheistic, believing in many gods. And you still have today those who believe in a personal god in India, the Bhaktis. But the highest and certainly the most influential stage of theism in India, or rather of theology in India, and certainly the most intellectually consistent, is the concept of monism. And this is what we'll be looking at. From the 9th century philosophy of Shankara, right down to the 19th century philosophy of Vivekananda, and into the 20th century with people like Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, Radhakrishna, and so on, the mainstream of Indian thought has been a non-dualist monism, what's called Advaita Vedanta. And this is undoubtedly still the most important school in India. So I don't think we're unjustified in looking at this school and its basic premises. Now, as a key to monism, let's first of all see how it tackles the problem of unity and diversity. Because monism tackles this problem of unity and diversity by answering it in terms of unity. Now, some of you will immediately wonder if this is significant at all, or whether, in fact, we're only discussing something that's really very obscure and philosophically complex and irrelevant. But in fact, the question of the one and the many, or unity and diversity, is much more than a philosophical problem. It's a basic area of many parts of life, even if you don't think about it. And it's certainly true that modern philosophy has grown camera shy of this question. But although modern philosophy rarely raises the question, and the reason is that it has no answer to it, and it knows it hasn't, in many areas, our modern society is an attempted answer to the same question. And this problem of unity and diversity is extremely important, because we'll see that the basic premises of monism, i.e. choosing unity rather than diversity, relate in the long run to the final forms of their culture, and the same will happen in the West. Now, the important thing is that monism is one answer to the problem of the one and the many. Because the problem is to try and see if either the unity or the diversity is more real, and if neither is more real, in other words, they're both important, how do you hold the two together in a balance between unity and diversity? Perhaps the best way of introducing this would be to ask the question, which is more real, a particular dog, such as a German Shepherd, a poodle, or a terrier, a particular dog, or the concept of dogginess? In other words, the particular dog is the world of diversity, many, many dogs, a whole range of dogs, all the different shapes, sizes, sounds, smells, etc., etc. Looked at one way, the particular dog is much more real, of course. It can be seen as it barks, heard as it barks, seen as it runs, felt, etc. But if you think of it another way, the concept of dogginess, although it's not open to any of the five senses, is actually more important because it's that which makes the dog a dog and not a cat. And long after all these particular dogs have died, the concept of dogginess persists and is really more important in some ways. You get it? Which is more important, the dog or the concept of dogginess, the diversity or the unity which makes the diversity unity within a specific species? So there's the question. Now, in answer to this question, the early Greek cynics and the modern existentialists agree in one side of the answer, and we'll see the Hindus and many others take the other answer. The existentialists say there can be no final unity. There's no universal. Man is left only with the diversity. And of course, in the resulting alienation of this position, all you have left is the individual position, authenticating himself without any universal meaning. And the wider universe is incapable of giving you any wider meaning. That's the problem of the existentialists. They have no final unity, only diversity. On the other hand, the problem of the Hindus and the Greeks, many of the Greeks rather, is that they explain the diversity in terms of the unity, saying the unity is more real. Plato, for instance, spoke of the phenomenal, in other words, the world we think is real, as the shadow of the real world, which is beyond our knowledge. In the same way, the Indians say that only the absolute self, God, is real. The world of diversity, which we think is real, is actually Maya or illusion. So this is a really important question. And at the beginning, you'll think this is just academic, philosophical games. But when it washes down in the rain of practical living, you'll see it has profound consequences. And this is the heart of the discussion this afternoon. So what we'll do is examine Indian monism and relate it to three crucial areas. Their understanding of what is reality, what is personality, and what is morality. In other words, the premises as they work out in practice, and then you'll see the logic of the thing. So here's the first crucial area, and I really urge you to think through these areas very sharply with me, because here's the heart of the discussion with anyone who's into the Eastern thing. First, monism and reality. If the unity alone is real, then what is the world of diversity, or the phenomenal external universe as we know it? In other words, the world all around us this afternoon, mountains, the valley, the chairs on which we're sitting, the floor, the ceiling, etc., etc.